dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of the countries that has been for many, many years now in the forefront of the war for the free world, the very front lines, one might say, is the nation of Israel. It has been one of America's closest allies, certainly its closest in the Middle East, and by and large, its most reliable of allies. And we have been watching with great and growing concern the difficulties the government of Israel has had in deciding who its leader is going to be and getting a program of action implemented under that new or perhaps existing leader's direction. A man who has been closely monitoring these matters for decades and is perhaps as knowledgeable about them as anybody in the United States is our guest, I'm very pleased to say, for this full hour. I'm even more pleased to say he is a new addition to the Center for Security Policy team as the director of a new program aimed at fighting global anti-Semitism and defending Israel. His name is Dr. David Wormser. Prior to joining the Center team, he has had a number of very important positions. He has been in the private sector, an executive member of the Delphi Global Analysis Group, but he served for 3 years as a senior advisor to the Vice President of the United States on the national security portfolio, namely then Vice President Dick Cheney. Prior to that time, he was a senior advisor to the Department of State. He has been the director of Middle East Studies at the American Enterprise Institute, and throughout all of this, he has been a member of the United States Navy Reserve, rising to the rank of lieutenant commander with a specialization in intelligence. He has a PhD from my alma mater, Johns Hopkins University, and he is a dear friend as well as a very valued colleague. Thrilled to have a chance to talk with him at length. David Wormser, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. There is a lot going on in your portfolio that I'm very keen to plumb with you and see if we can get some important insights into how on earth things have gotten so screwed up in Israel for so long and whether there's an end in sight and the implications more broadly for what is happening in the Middle East at the moment for our national security and that of the world. Before we get into all of that, David, though, I thought we might just level set a little bit by talking about the importance of Israel. Why should it matter to the United States? Who is running the country or what policies the state of Israel is pursuing?
Well, I think there's about three or four different levels in which that can be answered. The first is the outright is the strategic. There aren't a lot of allies we have in the Middle East that are both strong, capable, and very firmly rooted to the United States and its alliance. And the Israelis aren't just part of the West and aren't just pro-Western. They really are probably the closest ally we have anywhere if you look at voting patterns in the United Nations and so forth. So, and it's not even a question in Israel whether they're aligned with this bloc or that bloc. They're firmly 100% rooted in our bloc. So they're a good ally. That's the second thing. The second thing is they're a powerful ally in a region where, especially in a time when we're beginning to reevaluate exactly how much we want to be involved on an ongoing basis, daily basis, in the region, we're going to need to find like-minded friends, and Israel, as I said, is one of the closest friends we have, that will carry some of the water for us in the region to help us ensure that our interests are protected. So Israel's there, powerful, friendly, really the only truly unquestionably friendly country, as well as stable and powerful. So that's one level. The second level is on the level of values. The Jewish people in Israel are not an incidental to our world in the recent period, especially in terms of American formation. We were formed as the New Jerusalem here in the United States. We were always looking to the history of the Jewish people going back 3,000-4,000 years, and saw ourselves as part of that story, a new chapter in that story. So we always had this affinity with them, as long as they stayed close to who they were. So you see those two levels. The third, I would say, is something most people don't notice lately, is the economic. Israel is a very small country. If you're looking for a market to sell goods, this is not the place to go. I mean, they have a substantial market, given that they're a fairly wealthy country now, but that's not why people go there. The real reason why Israel is important economically is that it is becoming an innovation center, one of the two or three most important innovation centers in the world and the global economy at this point.
And that's particularly true in the high tech and biotech and those sorts of fields, right?
And yeah, defense, cybersecurity, and I'd argue the very initially emerging field of the quantum revolution, where the Israelis really are one of the top two countries in the world. And in fact, their scientists were some of the pioneers in the field to begin with. So what you see is that the way we defined after World War II's key places in the world were industrial capacity, upon which industrial capacity in the world relied, see the steel manufacturing in the Ruhr region of Europe. Israel now is re-emerging in this new economy that's been developing for the last 20 years and will accelerate, especially after the coronavirus. Israel is emerging as really one of the key industrial interests of the United States and our economy as well. So if you put all that together, Israel plays an outsized role for its size, but also it's a very unique role for an entire region of the world. There's nobody else in the Middle East who comes even close to playing those roles for us, essentially, in that region.
I want to come back to that point, but let me just say, as we wrap up this first segment, something that you alluded to there is particularly interesting, and that is the stability of Israel. And it's all the more remarkable in that we've seen now three different elections taking place to determine, as I said earlier, the premier of the country that have been somewhat, if not completely, inconclusive. They have not produced, to this point, a government. And when we come back from this short break, David Wormser, I'm very keen to get the latest update on how you think things are sorting with respect to the possible return to power of Benjamin Netanyahu, now in a caretaker role, perhaps in coalition with his very, very determined political opponent, Benny Gantz. We'll hit that and what has come of this turmoil in terms of politics in Israel and its role in the region with David Wormser, the new director of the program on Defending Israel and Combating Anti-Semitism at the Center for Security Policy, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We are visiting this full hour with Dr. David Wormser, a longtime advisor to former Vice President Richard Cheney. He has been a friend and colleague of mine and of the Center for Security Policy for decades, and we are thrilled to have him now with us as one of our own team. Among other things, he has spent much of his professional life as a Navy reservist specializing in intelligence, rising to the rank of lieutenant commander. And Commander, let me just ask you, as you look as an intelligence analyst at what has been going on with respect to the effort in Israel to form a government, which has now taken most of the past year, what's going on and where do you think they go from here?
Well, first, First of all, I think it makes me appreciate the American system of government that much more if I needed any more encouragement in that way. In the United States, when we have an election, it's decided the day of the election. There's a winner, there's a loser, it's a winner take all. So you know who's going to be the president the day after. Once the votes are counted, it's decided that the winner will be the president. And that's the way also for districts, for the House of Representatives and Senate and so forth. We have winner take all. So it's very decisive. Israel is a parliamentary democracy on Britain's model, which means you have an election. And it's almost never, basically, that one party wins the majority of seats. You have 10 parties or so in most of these parliaments. So there's going to be a coalition negotiation afterwards. And that process of form, in other words, there's no president elect the day after the election or prime minister elect the day after the election. There's just an inclination or a sense that this will be the coalition that will be formed. So the process of forming a coalition that will then have a majority in parliament among several parties is to be considered really still part of the election process. So the election doesn't really end until you have a coalitional agreement among enough parties to form, in Israel's case, a 61-seat majority in their parliament, which is called the Knesset. They have 120 seats, so 61 is the majority. What happened in Israel is both parties polled big parties. Likud aren't major parties. Likud under the current prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. And the second party under Benjamin Gantz or Benny Gantz, Blue-White Party, they polled both in the mid to lower 50s. So neither had a majority they needed. Well, their coalitional blocks that they could create polled in the mid lower to lower 50s. So neither could form a coalition. Why isn't that? How's that possible when you have 120 seats that neither could form a coalition? The reason for it is there's yet another party called the United List, which is an Arab party. It's a conglomeration of three Arab parties and the Israeli Communist Party. And they generally have been taboo to form a coalition with, not out of racist reasons or anything like that. Simply, the party, its platform is that Israel should be eliminated. And its members have gone to Damascus and Tehran and Ankara to meet with Erdogan and others to coordinate a policy openly. They do this overtly and openly to coordinate a policy to destroy Israel.
This, I have to say, David, that I think the average American listening to this would find this completely incomprehensible, that you could have people seated in the parliament of Israel, having access, presumably, to sensitive information and being able to cast votes and that sort of thing, even if they're not formally members of the executive branch, the government, they nonetheless are inside the wire, big time. How could this be?
It could be. I agree with you. And I think this has been a political issue in Israel, by the way, for a dozen or more years, which is that there should be an oath of office in Israel to maintain and support the state of Israel, which isn't a very high bar. The problem is that leftist parties, knowing that that will essentially eliminate their chance to form a government, have taken that to the Supreme Court and say it's discriminatory against Arabs. And the Supreme Court and the court system in Israel is not very neutral. Israel has a very serious problem.
Yes, I would say that's an understatement of epic proportions. It's a highly partisan, leftist-oriented branch of government, no?
Yeah, we can actually get into that and how this whole coalitional mess happened in Israel. They played a very bad and very dangerous role that will probably push the issue to a head in the next few months and year or so. But at any rate, because of that, the courts have always said, no, it's discriminatory against Arabs, and therefore you can't bar that party. So they get elected, they get in parliament, they cheer. You know, you have a surreal situation in the current parliament. They've already named two or three of the committees, and they've appointed the heads of those committees. And that party has gotten the head of the committee in Israel to deal with terror victims. So on Mother's Day among the Palestinians, which was last week, the party issued a congratulatory celebration message to the terrorist families And they control the committee that handles the affairs of the terror victims. You can imagine what sort of a political shock that was. You would have seen people in the streets if Israel was in the lockdown because of the coronavirus.
We're going to come to the coronavirus in a moment, but just quickly, David Wormser, let's talk about where things stand now after these many months of wrangling and elections and coalition negotiations failing to produce a governing coalition. Is there some light at the end of the proverbial tunnel? And is it, as they say, the oncoming train, or is Israel about to emerge with a ruling coalition that could actually have a coherent program?
I think Israel is about to emerge with a ruling coalition that is both Zionist and, I'd say, center-right. The reason for it is that this whole thing of trying to form a coalition with this United List party, the Arab party, so offended people in the center that the White Party under Benny Gantz now has split. And there are a number of people in that party who said they cannot go and form a government with the Arab List being so anti-Zionist and so forth. So Gantz realized he had one of two choices, a national unity government or go for fourth elections. And the trend in the last election was popularity toward Bibi Netanyahu, the current prime minister. Moreover, he handled the corona crisis very well in Israel. He's very popular at the way he's handling it. So a fourth election would have been a meltdown for the Blue-White Party. So I think Benny Gantz, I don't want to take away from him also the patriotism. The man had been chief of staff, dedicated his life to Israel.
Chief of the staff of the Israeli military, right?
Correct. So for him, it was very painful to even think of forming a coalition with the Arab party. But at the end of the day, he saw the writing on the wall, moved toward Netanyahu. Netanyahu had given him a lot of portfolios and other ministries in the government to control. So in the middle of the night, they worked out the parameters of a deal and essentially saved the day.
Now, this is going on against the backdrop, David, of Netanyahu having immense difficulties of his own. You were talking about the judiciary before. He's been indicted for various corrupt activities. Where do things stand with respect to his prosecution and its bearing on his ability to hold a position in government at this point?
Well, his trial was supposed to start last week. And I mean, and I think there's a lot to say about the indictment itself. But just first, the mechanics. The indictment was supposed to turn into a trial last week. But Israel is under lockdown because of the coronavirus, and the court system itself shut itself down because it's a gathering and it's dangerous. So they indefinitely postponed all court activity and the hold court. So his trial has been postponed indefinitely until this coronavirus crisis passes. So that's sort of put on the back burner. But that said, there's a very serious question about the indictment to begin with, because the crimes for which he was accused, first of all, the evidence is quite problematic. But more importantly, the crime itself is quite problematic. And many of us would recognize this from the indictment or the impeachment of the president. You sit back and you wonder, well, what exactly is the crime you're accusing him of? And that is exactly what happened with this, with the attorney general in Israel. He accused Netanyahu of a crime. It's not clear it ever was a crime, and it's not clear what the crime exactly is. It's bribery. We all understand what bribery is. But it was unclear that this is really a proper definition of bribery, because Netanyahu got nothing for it, which seems to be a quid pro quo is at the heart of a bribery accusation.
It is kind of like the president being accused of various things that it's not clear, for example, that quid pro quo business that he actually engaged in. And David, I guess the question has been, you know, whether it's cigars or whether it's favorable treatment in the media, whether this is in fact something that would rise to the level that it would preclude a man from serving in the highest position in his country, in Israel. And I gather the answer is that's still to be determined. But for the moment, just to get to the bottom line here, you think that there is going to be a coalition government in which Bibi Netanyahu and Benny Gantz will be alternating as premiers of the country?
Correct. They came to an agreement where Netanyahu would be the prime minister for the first 18 months. Gantz would be for the second 18 months. They divide which portfolios, which government ministries go to which party. And they also allocated who gets the speakership of the parliament, which Yuli Edelstein, the speaker aligned with Netanyahu, has left his post. And now they're discussing how to handle that with Gantz, because Gantz, when he leaves the position, they have to negotiate up front who will then replace him. And it looks like it'll be the former speaker, Yuli Edelstein, to take that position again.
The point is that it does seem as though, David Wormser, we're at the cusp of finally getting a governing coalition that can be the reliable ally and strong nation that we need Israel to be, for the reasons you mentioned earlier. There's more on all of this, by the way, folks, in a splendid live-streamed panel discussion that featured David Wormser and one of the center's other fellows, Carolyn Glick, on the 24th of March, and Fred Flights, our president, moderated it brilliantly. I commend it to you. It's available at our website, securefreedom.org. David Wormser, we'll be right back with much more right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We're visiting this full hour with Dr. David Wormser, former National Security Assistant to then Vice President Dick Cheney. He is a man who has served in a variety of capacities, both in uniform of the United States Navy and in the civilian side of the United States government. And I'm thrilled that he is now a senior analyst with the Center for Security Policy and the director of its Project on Global Antisemitism and the U.S.-Israel Relationship. And again, I commend to all of you a terrific program that he and our colleague Carolyn Glick participated in on the 24th of March, in which we've talked about a number of the subjects that we're visiting with David about today at greater length. David, I wanted to talk a bit about the other part of your portfolio. You've very nicely described what's going on in Israel and its importance to us. Let's talk about anti-Semitism and why it is so important that it be combated, not just, you know, for Jewish folks who obviously have a very direct interest in it, but for all of us who love freedom and who appreciate that this is really just one of the totalitarian's assaults on Western civilization.
Well, yes. I mean, I think you nailed it, which is that one has to look at anti-Semitism not only in the context of Jews. You have to look at it in terms of what is animating, what is motivating anti-Semites to do what they do and think what they think. Often what you see is it's precisely the symbolism or the structure of Judaism or the history of Judaism that is part of the Western and part of especially the American understanding of the evolution of the West. It's a backdoor attempt to attack that, our founding ideas. So in many ways, you will never or very rarely find an anti-Semite who is genuinely in his heart pro-American. And by that, I mean, you know, you could have some white nationalist who flies a flag, but what I mean by that is that there are some definable ideas around which the United States is organized, starting from really the 800 years of British experience, and then 1776, and that's what's under attack by anti-Semitism often.
I couldn't agree more. And yet, David, what we are finding now, sometimes in the guise of anti-Zionism or simply anti-Israel posturing, is becoming mainstream, notably within the Democratic Party. Bernie Sanders, a candidate for president in that party, the so-called Squad, Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib, two Muslim members of Congress, most obviously, but really the rest of that sort of radical cohort and the progressives in the party seemingly have now let the mask slip and are more and more overtly hostile, not just to Israel, not just to Zionism, but to Jews more generally. Talk about that phenomenon and what's driving it and what it means.
Well, it is, there's two things driving it. One is those who are anti-Semites and they use the formula that essentially this innocent step back and say, what, We're not allowed to criticize another country. Of course, you're allowed to criticize another country. Israel is simply a normal country in that way. When they do things wrong, one should criticize them. I've criticized Israel in the past as well, not usually from the direction that many would like, but I, you know, more in the direction of thinking that they've been too weak in certain places. But that said, Israel's open criticism. Israel's a highly hyper self-critical country as well. But the question is, when you criticize Israel, are you holding them to a standard unique to Israel, an impossible standard? And that, at that point, when you have a double standard, when you have a code of accusation or an accusations that are based on a code of ethics that are either impossible, invented in classic cases of anti-Semitism, or are not applied to anybody else, anywhere else in the world, that becomes anti-Semitism. And that's what you're seeing with a lot of this criticism of Israel. They invent facts because they need to make Israel look a lot worse than actually Israel ever is. Then they say Israel's doing things that frankly everybody does and is part of the normal functioning of a nation defending itself usually. And then essentially at the heart of it says that the Jewish people alone among all peoples have no right, don't have the same rights as other people, and included among them is a right to be a people and to be a nation, and that others have a lot of rights to just, it's a fact, just overpower that right, period. That's anti-Semitism, but it's a very difficult accusation to parry, because they come right back and they say, well, that's criticize another nation. So that's really one of the more difficult aspects of anti-Semitism. And again, going back to the first part of our program, Israel represents such an important part of our defense structure in the region. It is a symbol, our local symbol of freedom, and it is our ally. So therefore, a lot of this use of anti-Semitism is also a backdoor use to strategically attack a fundamental interest of the United States.
And indeed, the United States itself, as you said, David Wormser. This makes the work you're about with this project on combating anti-Semitism, I think, such vital work. And I commend you for taking it on and look forward both to visiting with you often about how it's going, and of course doing whatever we can to reinforce the message that you're communicating, that this is really unacceptable, particularly as it is now increasingly being, as I said, mainlined into the body politic. I'm hopeful that one of the things that we will find in the course of this upcoming 2020 election is this will be repudiated very strongly by the American people and hopefully set back the anti-Semites' agenda. Let me turn to a subject you have also spent much of your professional life working on. David Wormser, you mentioned the coronavirus a moment ago in connection with how well Israel's handling it. A nation that is not handling it well, or for that matter, the plague of locusts that is afflicting it at the moment, or the cratering of the economy, thanks in part to what Donald Trump has done with his maximum pressure campaign, and in part, I think, with respect to what the Saudis are doing to take down the price of oil, with help from the Russians, of course. It's to the detriment of our fracking industry, and we'll talk about that maybe in a minute, but it's been very hard on Iran as well. Talk about what's going on in Iran at the moment, David, and what is the prognosis for the people of Iran actually finally freeing themselves of this regime that brutally represses them and threatens us?
Yeah, thanks for bringing it up, Frank. This is really an important, really probably one of the most important developments in the Middle East. We already had, before the corona crisis, an Iranian government in serious crisis. It is one of the reasons why they're lashing out at us, why they escalated last summer, why they tried to kill some of our servicemen a month ago, why they keep trying to do it this week. The more desperate they become, you know, one must understand this government there is run by a group, a narrow clique, a subgroup of the Iranian Revolution that believes in the imminent apocalypse, the Mahdi, the vanished Mahdi that they believe in will come back, but that the act of faithfulness, which in Islamic revolutionary context is to assert the Islamic revolution, to be aggressive, the act of faith will bring about the return. So we're dealing with people who are operating in a different framework than we would understand. There are discussions of interests don't really apply in this circumstance. I raise this because right now you have the coronavirus in Iran, which they claim, even what they admit to makes it one of the worst countries right now. But what they admit to, everybody, even the World Health Organization, which has displayed itself to be awfully awful, basically, and kowtowing to certain governments. Even the World Health Organization says that there's a minimum 5 to 10 times as much cases and deaths in Iran than what they're admitting to, which makes them the worst case in the world. But honestly, when you look at the numbers and things going on, who's getting it, and the spread of it geographically, we don't know the parameters of it, but it's horrific in Iran. So you have a government who is facing a genuine apocalypse from the virus. The United States offers them help. They turn it down and they say, we don't need your help. You're evil. They deny, and then they start sending missiles onto our forces again in Iraq through their proxies in the last week. Why? The only explanation for that is, and this is very, very worrisome, is they may read this as a sign. They may read this as a sign that the moment of truth is approaching. And if that's what you believe, you will display your faithfulness, namely commitment to the jihad, and so forth. So we're entering, I believe, the period in which the Iranian government is most desperate, most dangerous, and its ideology, ironically, at that moment seems to be most validated by circumstances. So I see Iran entering a period of severe regime threat internally, mixed with severe regime threatening externally. Sure enough, what we see is their nuclear program being accelerated very rapidly.
David, hold the thought, because we have to take a short break. When we come back, I want to just wrap this up and see whether there's hope at last for a change of regime, or whether we are just facing a much more serious threat there. That and much more with David Wormser of the Center for Security Policy, right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back for our fourth and final installment of this very interesting, informative, and not a little troubling discourse with our friend and colleague, David Wormser. Dr. Wormser is now managing the Center for Security Policy's project Defending Israel and Combating Anti-Semitism. And David, you were talking about Iran before the break, and I just wanted to close up with one quick question to you. You mentioned that there seem to be some divisions within the government as well as massive divisions within the country of Iran. One of the people who has been prominently a face of the regime for a long time is its foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif. He made a speech recently in which he was heard to talk about the need for, quote, reconstructing, unquote, the Iranian system of governance. It's a little unclear what exactly that means. There are some who have been pointing out the real problems with its form of government for quite some time, and it might be a positive sign if that's what he's talking about. Or it may just be sort of smoke and mirrors, for which Zarif is famous. What did you make of that speech? And more generally, do you think there's a signal here that an opportunity at last for the fundamental transformation, to use Barack Obama's phrase, of the Iranian regime might actually be at hand?
Well, I mean, in the case of Zarif, I don't think there's a fundamental transformation that is capable in that regime without bringing it down. I don't believe in a third-way Islamic Republic any more than I thought there was a third-way communism. It's an on-off switch. Once it goes down, it goes down. Zarif, his speech, one has to remember the role of Zarif is to be, it's sort of the old Soviet strategy on steroids where they had good cop, bad cop.
The hawks and doves in the Kremlin, right?
That's right. The hawks and doves and the moderates and hardliners. And the more we take a hardline position ourselves, it validates the hardliners and discredits the moderates. And they played us like fiddle in the Cold War. They're playing us even more like a fiddle now. Iranians are the master manipulators of this government. And that may be what it's about. And by the way, it's also internal to tell their own people, it's okay. I know that you guys are dissatisfied and so forth, but we're good. We have internal debate. And so I think they're playing both their own people and us for a game here. That's number one. That said, the fact that he feels he needs to do it tells me they're scared. So that's the signal I would take from this, is they're becoming desperate. Now, are there fissures? Yes. Right off the bat, though, do not ever believe that they're moderates and hardliners. It's just different paths to insanity.
And David, just quickly, as a fellow who advised Dick Cheney on Iran, among other things in the past, what would your counsel be to Donald Trump now with respect to Iran and trying to stave off the idea that this is the end time that will bring back the Mahdi and thereby unleash perhaps some sort of apocalypse upon us all?
Well, I served in the Bush administration, and I have a lot of respect for Vice President Cheney. He always had a very clear idea and knew exactly where we needed to go. And I think once the full documentation is exposed, whenever the declassifications happen, he will look as a man of great principle and strategic vision. That said, I think the second term of the Bush administration, we acted toward Iran a bit like the last remake of Bojess with Michael York and Marty Feldman, where you draw a line in the sand and you just stepped over the line and you said, well, if you don't like that, then there's the next line. We kept drawing these lines in the sand. They kept crossing it. And we said, no, well, we're going to draw a new one and we really mean it. And of course, the Obama administration shred any attempt at trying to hold the line. And they basically thought you could co-opt these people and worried more about an Israeli strike than they worried about Iran getting the bomb. And then generally, I think it was larger outlook on the world, which is, well, all these countries are getting their nuclear weapons because we're so aggressive. So if we gave up our weapons and there was global disarmament, they wouldn't need it and they'd give up. So we've really not dealt with this issue. And the one thing I have to say about President Trump, he has been very strong and very clear-headed about this. And he has not buckled. He's not drawing lines and saying, well, if you don't like that one, we'll draw another line. He's going for the jugular.
No, he seems to be. But David, let me just ask you very quickly, in closing on this topic, there is a report that the government of the United States has decided to extend for another 60 days a waiver on the sanctions that Donald Trump has quite properly reinstituted on Iran in order to allow it to continue doing nuclear-related work. Have you seen that report, and what do you make
of
it?
Yes, I have. It's a leftover of the JCPOA, what's more commonly known as the Iran deal of the Obama administration. It is essentially the idea was, well, if they're going to have this nuclear program, we at least should be involved in making sure it's safe. And there was this surreal issue where we had to protect it. So we kind of wound up being in the position under that deal of protecting Iran's nuclear program from potential Israeli attack. That was a sidebar. Nobody, the people did notice at the time. But that's part of the larger rubric of we need to maintain safety of that program because that would help us if they have a big nuclear accident, everybody can. So we do these waivers under that context. But that, of course, opens the door for the continued legitimacy of that program. And therein lies the problem. And I think this is the real final legacy of the Obama administration that has to be unpacked and unraveled, which is that program needs to be shut down full stop. No residual program that then is the hook through which you still have international cooperation.
I couldn't agree more. And I hope the administration will see the wisdom of that, despite the latest evidence to the contrary. David, lastly, and very quickly, I just wanted to ask you, again, you've studied the Middle East probably as closely as anybody. One of the phenomena that we have watched with growing concern is, of course, the rise of what I call Sharia supremacism. It's not just in the Middle East or North Africa or even elsewhere in Africa. It is now very much alive in Europe. And one of the manifestations of it is the phenomenon of no-go zones in Europe. And the French government, I talked about this yesterday with David Greenfield, has gone so far as to say that the no-go zones in France do not need to conform to the steps the French government is requiring all of their other citizens to engage in, namely a lockdown, in order to defeat the Chinese Communist Party virus, I call it, the COVID-19 virus. The implications of this for France and, for that matter, Europe and I think the rest of us are stunning. I just wanted to get your thoughts on this as an expression of, you know, the kinds of demands that the Sharia supremacists are making and the dangers of accommodating them.
Well, sure. Look, I think that the coronavirus has exposed the moral bankruptcy of the European Union leadership and a lot of the national leaderships that are aligned with the European Union. We saw how they didn't want to close borders until it was so dangerous they were forced to. They didn't want to stop flights from China until they were vastly infected. There's just one thing after another, and this is already before the corona crisis. They had a lot of crises. The moral bankruptcy of the European Union leadership is being exposed. And one of the big corruptions they've had is this fawning in front of Islamist forces. And part of it is because they don't want to confront Erdogan, who's funding and fueling and organizing massively these Muslim Brotherhood movements in Europe. But part of it was simply part of the political correctness that's afflicted Western governments and Western societies, that we don't want to say anything bad about the Muslim community because we don't want to be racist and so forth. So that morphed eventually into bending over backwards to be pro-Muslim, to show how grand we are, how tolerant we are. Well, that's the last myth on the table, that the European Union is falling back into its bunker to defend right now.
And what this amounts to, David, and we are hard out of time, I'm afraid, is whatever their intentions are, whatever their hope for the result, it is going to be seen by these Sharia supremacists, their adversaries and ours, as submission, which has the effect of, unfortunately, reinforcing both their appetites, the Sharia supremacists, and their determination to achieve their goals at our expense and that of Western civilization more generally. Not a happy prospect. David Wormser, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you so much for this hour of your time, for the insights you've shared with us, and the great work that you're doing these days at the Center for Security Policy on combating anti-Semitism and defending Israel. Godspeed in that work, my friend. Come back to us again soon, if you would, and I hope the rest of you will do the same. Again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.